Well, it's all about time. It is 23 and a half past the hour on a Tuesday morning. It seems to be to the second that we always bring in Dr. Don. And that's he's a regular guy. And we're glad we have him this morning. Dr. Don Clark, a biochemist, a member of the Board of Creation Moments, and the only scientist we have on staff here at Broken Road Radio. And he lives in Garden Valley, Texas, and he's kind enough to join us. Don, good morning. David's got five above. What do you have?
Oh, we have 44 here.
Oh,
bright and sunny and 44, and the temperature is rising.
Does that mean that we're nine times warmer than East Dakota? Would that be scientifically accurate?
Yeah, close to that.
Okay. Well, we're talking about time this morning, and it's about time we did, because I'm thoroughly confused. Well, there's an article. There's a link in the chat window of BrokenRoadRadio.com to this article. It's on the World News page, and it has to do with the dating habits of Earth scientists, is the only way I can put this. And it starts with a discussion of absolute time. Now, Don, David says that absolute time is when his wife Carol says it is.
That's right.
How would you define it?
That just illustrates how relative time is. Right?
And, good point.
Einstein was the one that actually figured that out, that time and space were relative. He finally came up with his general theory of relativity, in which, time is indeed a part of this space-time continuum that we live in, which we've talked about before, but that's not the topic today. I'm just saying, for your benefit as well. But so geologists like to talk about absolute time. You know, that they have determined the absolute time of the rocks and the rock layers and the absolute time. And of course, the paleontologists have then said, well, if we know the absolute time of the rock, then we know the absolute time of this fossil that died absolutely so many thousands, hundreds of thousands of years ago. But it turns out that is not quite accurate, because their dating techniques, of course, rely on isotopic ratios. And the most common dating technique, at least that people are familiar with, because you find a fossil and you might say, well, how old is this fossil? So you send it to the lab and you ask the lab to run carbon-14 dating on it. And voila, they come back with an answer. And you say, wow, okay, so that I found something very, very old. Well, yeah, maybe. But we can use carbon-14 as an illustration to the other dating techniques that they use on rocks, because I think that will get us into the subject, and then we can probably go from there. But carbon comes in three forms: carbon-12, carbon-13, and carbon-14. And carbon-14 is made in the upper atmosphere, and so there's a lot of carbon-12 around, and there's not quite as much as carbon-13, and then when we get to carbon-14, we don't have very much at all. But carbon is obviously deposited in our bodies through breathing the air.
Yeah, we are carbon-based life forms, are we not? I've heard that.
Yes, and so we take the CO2... We take the CO2, we expire the CO2, and the trees take the carbon dioxide and make sugars with them, and then we eat the sugars in the form of starches and stuff. And then the amount of carbon-14 that was in the leaf or was in the fruit or was in the vegetable is the amount of carbon-14 that we've taken in. So that and then of course when you die, you're not taking in any more carbon-14 because you're not eating anything anymore, surprisingly enough. And when you die, then whatever the carbon-14 levels was at the time of death then starts to decay. And then we know relatively what the decay rate of carbon-14 is. That's 5,700 in, I think, 40 years or 30 years. Based on the decay rate, you can then figure out, okay, how long ago did this creature die? And based on the amount of carbon-14 in the sample relative to the amount we know today. And so you can, date that
fairly. Let me back up a second. How do they determine how much carbon was there to begin with? By using a living thing now and using that as the standard? I mean, if they want to know that half of it has disappeared, they got to know what they started with.
Right. Well, in the case of carbon-14, for example, we know approximately how much should have been there at the time the animal died. And part of the assumption is that we assume that what the carbon-14 level is in the atmosphere today was in the atmosphere when the animal died. And so we know the starting carbon-14 level, and we know the half-life, that is how long does it take for half of the carbon-14 to degrade. That is 5,730 years. And that we can determine in the laboratory by taking measurements and just watching it decay. And there's well-known decay equations, which are fairly simple. And then we can back calculate what the half-life is, measure the amount of carbon-14 in the sample of interest, and based on that amount and the starting amount, we can say, aha, this animal died, let's say it was two half-lives ago, which would then make it 11,460 years old. So that's how that particular process works. Carbon-14, by the way, degrades into, or I should, up to nitrogen. Nitrogen-14, it loses a beta particle, and thereby you go from six protons to seven protons in the nucleus. And of course, the protons determine the characteristic of the element that we're talking about. And so,
does that nitrogen dissipates into the air?
No, the nitrogen-14 is stable.
Okay, so it's still in
it's obviously it's a gas, so it would eventually leak out of the matrix of bones, for example.
Here's a dumb question then: if the carbon-14 is there and the nitrogen-14 is there, they can add the two together and see how much carbon-14 there was to begin with, unless that nitrogen also comes from other sources.
Well, we've got nitrogen-14 all over us.
Okay.
I mean, there's, we got nitrogen. Most of our atmosphere is nitrogen, so it would be you can't use the nitrogen-14.
Gotcha. Okay.
In that case, and by the way, it's not radioactive, so it's it's just what is natural. I mean, it's not giving off anything that you can measure.
Okay, so you can't detect it by machinery like you can carbon-14 because it's radioactive.
Well, I mean, you can by specific,
spectrometry. Okay.
Analysis and various things, but it's a different analytical tool than necessarily what we use for carbon-14.
And I'm not trying to confuse things. I'm just kind of making the point here that there are a lot of variables in this thing, aren't there?
They are. And so, you get to the question of, how low levels of carbon-14 can we detect in a sample? And that, turns out to be, we can go back 50,000 years, maybe 100,000 years. We can detect now with the newer instruments very, very small amounts of carbon-14, so we can go back that far. Well, that presupposes that nothing happened to your sample in that the carbon-14 didn't leach out for some reason. Presupposes that you didn't have any other conditions like, oh my goodness, we had an abundance of carbon-14 at one, you know, at some point, or we had a depletion of carbon-14 in the atmosphere for whatever reason.
So the assumption is that carbon-14 has been a steady component in the same proportion of the atmosphere throughout history.
That is correct. That's a uniformitarianism. Mm-hmm. That's how we get to old ages. That's how we get old, is because we're uniformly degrading. No.
Well, speak for yourself there.
Anyway, we are, that's one of the assumptions. Now, unless you've got some exterior data that says, oh, you know, by the way, we had a lot of volcanic activity in this time period, and that volcanic activity would have inhibited the production of carbon-14, like at the time of the flood. We might say, okay, the conditions that we see today have always been around, and so making that assumption isn't too bad. But of course, we weren't back there in history to know, except that we do have evidence of a global flood, and we do have evidence of massive volcanic activity at the time of the global flood. So that throws a monkey wrench into all of this. Regardless of the radioactive dating technique that you're using, which, of course, those folks that are using radioactive dating techniques don't take that into account. So that throws a big error into things.
So a bunch of scientists got together and said, look, if we're going to have a useful tool for dating these old things, we're going to have to slough off and ignore some variables. Otherwise, we'll never get there. We'll never have a tool that we can use to be absolutely correct. So we'll take those variables and just kind of shave them off and pretend they don't exist.
Yes, or because they can't answer the questions, and so this is kind of the best that we can do,
mm-hmm.
type of thing. All right. So now let's talk about when you're doing analytical analyses, you have two parameters. One is precision, and the other is accuracy. So I'll give an example of that. Say that you're shooting a gun or a rifle at a target, and you're trying to hit the bullseye. But instead of hitting the bullseye, you're kind of off. So you're at the third ring, let's say. But you're putting every bullet in the same area. So you've got extreme precision with your shooting, but you're not very accurate because you're mm-hmm. off of the bullseye.
You've got a good right? group there, but you're only wounding him. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So that is what's happening with radioisotopic dating. Mm. We can take a rock, for example, and we can measure the uranium-lead ratio, for example. That's one of the techniques used to date data rock. And we can measure the uranium quite well. We can measure the lead, which is the ultimate decay product of uranium. It goes through several multiple steps in order to get to lead, but for simplicity's sake, we can measure those two elements in the rock, and we can get a ratio. And we can say, oh, okay, we got this much lead and we got this much uranium. We assume that, everything started at uranium, and so we're left with whatever the ratio is, uranium to lead. That's how old the rock is.
Okay, I'm missing a piece of information here. Carbon-14 is uranium?
No, carbon-14 is carbon-14. Uranium is uranium. Mm-hmm. Both are radioactive, we have jumped. I'm sorry. I have
Well, that's okay.
Jumped
I've been known to get lost easily here, so.
Yes. One dating method. Carbon-14, you can, like I said, you can only go back 100,000 years or so. Okay. So you have to use some other isotope that has a much longer half-life.
Gotcha. Okay.
That 5,730 years. So uranium has a very long half life. At least one of the isotopes of the uranium has a very long half life, and so, you know, we can use that same, basically the same technique, except we don't know really what the starting ratios were, but we are assuming in most cases that there is no lead in the sample, which is not a very good assumption. So at any rate, it's basically the same technique where you measure the ratio. And you take the rock and you measure the ratio in one part of the rock, and then you take the rock again, measure the portion in another part of the rock. And in that particular rock, your answers are going to, you know, the ratio is going to stay probably fairly constant. So that's pretty precise for that rock, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, you got the same answer over and over again. But what's not precise is the accuracy.
Ah.
You don't know what that ratio is telling you. You're assuming certain things, and we'll go into the assumptions here in a minute, but you don't know that the date that you calculated from that those radioactive isotope ratios is accurate or not. And so you just make the assumption, oh, you know, what we see today is what was back then, and so therefore I'm going to assume that nothing has changed, and so therefore it's got to be accurate. All right, well, that becomes a big problem from the standpoint of, well, you weren't living back then, and you're not taking the written history of the Earth into account, and we're assuming that nothing has changed, but indeed, you know, a lot of things have changed. And one of the things, you know, so one of the assumptions, for example, is we can measure, can we measure the decay rates accurately? And
this is, you know, where it gets complicated, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And so answering that question, I mean, you know, a study has recently been done. I don't know how recent, doesn't give the date in the article, but it says, you know, from the Brookhaven National Labs and several other labs, Baylor College of Medicine, for example, Purdue University, they've measured the decay rates of several elements such as magnesium, silicon, radium, and chlorine, and they noticed a seasonal fluctuation, that is within 1 year, a seasonal fluctuation of about 0.3% in the decay rate with the season. And they speculate that, well, that's possibly due to the distance of the sun to the Earth. So the decay rate then is perhaps dependent on the amount of energy coming from the sun, or at least reaching the Earth, and so it's got fluctuation on a seasonal basis. Well, that's just 1 year. I mean, how can you then stipulate that decay rate has to be constant over you know, millions of years, or you know, billions of years? And of course, the answer to that question, you can't.
Well, there must be other, just plain, without fancy equipment, other than maybe drilling a deep core into the Earth and pulling out a sample. Can't they then read that? They use mass spectrometers or something to analyze various portions of the core. Can they age the Earth that way? Or tree rings?
Well, you're still left with the same problem. In the layers, by the way, the layers that we see around the world, and, you know, you head west, young man, you do see the results of the global flood pretty obviously as you look at the badlands and look at the layers and the rocks, and sometimes they're quite colorful. You know, that's residual sedimentary deposits due to the flood. It has nothing to do with the age of the Earth if it was laid down at the time of the flood, because it was laid down very, very quickly as the floodwaters, either as the waters rushed onto the land, or the waters receded very quickly, then you would have these multiple layers, as we found from the Mount St. Helens eruption. So, the layers that you see in the Grand Canyon, those layers weren't laid down, over millions and millions of years. They were laid down, relatively close to the time of the flood, if not at the time of the flood, and several episodes post-flood, laid down those layers. So you can't just look at the layers and say, okay, well, I got all these layers. That's going to determine the time of the dating. And the other thing is, because sedimentary rock is a mixture of all kinds of things, obviously, mixture of several different rocks, not necessarily uniform, you can't use sedimentary rocks to date, because you're not going to get, depending on, what sample you're taking, you're going to get drastically different.
And isn't that where most fossils are found, in sedimentary rock?
Fossils, yes. So that's a problem. Fossils are found in sedimentary rock, interestingly enough. That's where we would expect them to be found if their death was the result of the flood. You would expect them to be in the sedimentary rock. And so what they do is they look at the igneous rock, that is the rock from volcanic flows, for example, and say, okay, that layer is relatively stable, so we can take radioisotopic data from those layers, and we find a flow that's above a fossil, and find a flow that is below a fossil, and that way we can bracket the age of the fossil, and we can date the fossil that way. But as you said, most of the fossils aren't found with the volcanic flows above and below, and so
okay. Now I have another question. I'm leading into something here. Can you detect carbon-14 in an igneous or rock formed by fire, by volcanic activity? Can you measure carbon-14 in igneous rock?
Well, interesting that you said that, because there was back in 2000, the Institute of Creation Research commissioned a radioactive age of the Earth study called the RATE study, and you can go on ICR's website and pull this up. There's even, a small booklet, a book written about it. And they go into this whole issue of radioactive decay and looking at carbon-14. They sent out samples, for example, just of coal and diamond samples. Now, diamond is the hardest known substance here on Earth. And, coal is not so hard, but they sent those samples out. And all the dates came back, the diamond you would have thought would have been millions of years old if it was similar to the rock that it was found in. But they all came back within, 6,000 years of, the time period of the Earth as determined by the young Earth creationists.
In other words, there were still readable carbon-14, which should have long disappeared if they were, in fact,
exactly,
millions of years old. Okay.
Yes. So that was the issue, and that was the great discovery that, hey, there's still carbon in these samples. There shouldn't have been carbon in these samples. If the coal is millions of years old, there shouldn't be carbon in the samples. And you can argue, well, coal is pretty porous and therefore could have picked up carbon from its surrounding areas. And okay, give you that argument, but not diamond. Diamond is the hardest thing known to man, so it's not going to be perturbed by the environment. Maybe a little, but not very much. At any rate, so that... that kind of proved that, we have a problem here with all of this dating technique, And perhaps we shouldn't be relying so heavily on it because it's not giving us, it's giving us answers. But like I said, you can be very precise, but you can be completely be missing the target with regard to the date. And that's, I think, is what we are seeing here with all of these dating techniques. But the scientists, the geological scientists who are dating these rocks, of course, are pretty firm as to, oh yes, this this is this sample is, you know, 4.5 million years old, and that's how old the Earth is, and so, or billions of years or whatever, and so therefore we know the age of the Earth, we know the age of the dinosaurs, we know when everybody lived here on Earth. And we can build this thing called the geological column. And of course, we need deep time or old age in order to support our evolutionary theory, and everything fits together. Well, everything doesn't fit together, because I've mentioned a couple of errors in their assumptions. And there's even more assumptions that they make in order for these radioactive dates to come out the way they want. You can use two different dating techniques, or two different ratios, or three different ratios of radioisotopes, and come up with completely different answers. Hmm. So you're left with which one do I pick?
Well, this seems to be a matter of course for particularly evolutionary thinking, is that if there's a variable that you can't account for, that you can't measure, ignore it. And that would include biblical history, and it would include the very existence of a creator. Rule it out, because we can't measure it. We can't validate it empirically.
Well, right. So if you throw it out, then you're throwing out, good historical, it's like... let's not look at our history books at all, and then we're going to try to come up with an answer that you could easily read about one of the oldest history books we have, and come up with the answer. So, yes, we have to ignore all of that, because this is pure science after all, and we can't bring religion into any of this.
Yeah, I beg to differ. It sounds an awful lot like a philosophy to me. Even a faith system on its own, evolution does. And it's interesting. It's kind of addicting, I suppose. But not if you take in the big picture. Then it kind of evaporates. The validity, the veracity of it just evaporates. We're talking with Dr. Don Clark, member of the Board of Creation Moments. I want to mention their website to you, creationmoments.com. And there you'll find a full library of DVDs and books and blogs and articles that support the biblical story of creation. And that's something that you at least have to take into account, deciding for yourself how old the Earth is, when the dinosaurs roamed, when man was made, and what's happened in between. And we thank Don Clark for joining us this morning. This is quite a journey you took us on today.
Yes, it has.
Still doing a little head scratching there, but okay. Hope everybody's with us. Don, thanks very much. We'll see you in a week or so, okay?
Okay, sounds
good. Take good care. Bye-bye.
Be blessed.